W.E.B. Du Bois was one of America's foremost intellectuals and civil rights leaders. The first African American to receive a Ph.D. from Harvard, he was a prolific historian, sociologist, and social critic. Souls of Black Folk, his most important book, appeared 100 years ago this month. According to my guest, David Levering Lewis, its publication in 1903 was one of those events dividing history into a before and an after. The book, he says, redefined the terms of a 300-year interaction between black and white people. David Levering Lewis is a professor of history at Rutgers University, a MacArthur Fellow, and the author of a two-volume biography of W.E.B. Du Bois, both volumes of which received the Pulitzer Prize. Professor Lewis, welcome.
It's good to be here.
Du Bois was born free in Massachusetts in 1868, the year coincidentally in which the 14th Amendment granted citizenship to black Americans. How did he come to know racism?
Du Bois speaks to that point quite poignantly in the Souls of Black Folk when he describes a moment in the high school, or it may have been elementary, the versions alter as the years pass, when as an exercise in good manners, the students were exchanging visiting cards, and a newcomer to Great Barrington, his little township in western Massachusetts, burned his card. And he writes that at that moment the veil descended, and he knew from that moment that he, though much alike with the others in heart and mind because of skin color, was different. It's particularly poignant because it's the first use of the term or the metaphor, the veil, which was to be rather a signature term in Du Bois's writing to indicate the divide that came upon America after the Civil War based on pigment.
The Souls of Black Folk consists of 14 essays, some of them previously published. What was the genesis of the book as a book?
Well, I think by 1901 or 2, as you say, only five of the collection's essays are original to the collection. I think he felt that the state of race relations, North and South, had reached such a point of oppressive disequilibrium that something had to be said. And what particularly drove him was the famous bargain that had been struck between the leadership in the South of African Americans, represented by Booker Washington, and the white South. And he thought that it was just absolutely necessary to state unequivocally that the surrender of civil rights in exchange, supposedly, for economic progress, slowly but surely, was a very bad bargain. And so I think the essay of Booker T. Washington and others, that essay is really the main point of the collection, although, of course, it's so rich and varied that it is simply one of the many extraordinary reflections upon the time and the status of race relations.
Well, Du Bois says in that essay on Washington that Booker T. Washington is the most distinguished Southerner since Jefferson Davis. Now, there might be some present-day U.S. senators who take that as praise, but Du Bois didn't mean it that way, obviously.
No, no, he didn't. What he meant to suggest was that if Jefferson Davis was a disaster for the Republic and certainly for the kind of society that would have prevailed had the South won the war, in many ways, Booker Washington represented the victory of the South in defeat, in the area at least of race relations, in that he was the agent of the manipulative planters and businessmen who were calling the shots after the dismantlement of Reconstruction in the late 1870s.
Du Bois writes at several points in the book that a black person in America has a double consciousness. What did he mean by that phrase?
Well, I think he meant that one could be in the social contract and in American society, and yet strangely and painfully not of it, in that because of the I suppose one would say the nationalization of the one drop rule of group identity, one drop of Negro blood disabled you. It meant that 10% of the population was in fact marginalized. And so irrespective of success, irrespective of the commitment to all the virtues and values of the society, there was this box in which people found themselves and were unable to get out of it.
It's as if almost he's rejecting a couple of other alternatives. There would be those who would want blacks to be segregated, to be separate from whites. Others want them to be somehow assimilated. And Du Bois seems to reject both of those. He says at one point he doesn't want to Africanize America, nor does he want to bleach his Negro soul.
Yes, I think that's particularly significant, that paragraph, because my reading of it is that it was a clear and rather smart adumbration of multiculturalism at the top of the 20th century. It has to be remembered that there were a number of thinkers of that period who were increasingly unhappy with the melting pot paradigm. Horace Kallen, most particularly, who spoke for Jewish Americans, but there were others like the Hapgood brothers who spoke for ethnic Americans, who thought that there was in the American experience room for retention of cultural and even linguistic traditions, and that the rather forcing house design in which people were to be mainstreamed on a model that pretty well approximated the Anglo model, the WASP model, was not entirely desirable. And that's what Du Bois was really saying, that there should be room for the enriching experience and complementarity of blackness and whiteness, with both respecting each other's cultures and space, as it were.
One evidence of that, it seems to me, comes before every chapter in the book. Every chapter is prefaced by a few measures of music, unidentified music, and by words of poetry. The music turns out to be music of blacks, the poetry often of canonical white poets. What was Du Bois' purpose in including them in the way he did?
It was to those epigraphs, as you say, that top each chapter, were intended to signal that the message of the songs sung in bondage by people of color, that is, the spirituals, must be appreciated, and the words written in freedom by white people would remain hollow and counterfeit until the message of the sorrow songs was appreciated. And so there was a complementarity of understanding that was necessary in order for democracy and human rights really to make their way.
Was he also, in a sense, challenging the traditional cultural hierarchy, which placed white stuff at the top?
Indeed so. It was subversive in that sense. The message of the semi-literate people coming out of bondage was as profound, as significant, as liberatory as the, as you put it, the canonical verse of Swinburne or Tennyson or Ruskin, say.
Du Bois advocates racial equality, but that doesn't seem to have stopped him from being on occasions an elitist himself.
Well, yes, I don't suppose there's any necessary conflict between the two. Elitism is completely, I would have thought, compatible with racial equality. That is to say, I think that it's simply a realistic admission or concession that in every society, in every place and time, some people are more endowed than others, either through opportunity or through native gift. So Du Bois, in the early part of the 20th century, simply accepted the fact that a much disabled group, because of the experience of slavery, could find its way best by being represented by its best. But by best, he did not mean elitism or snobbery in any parochial or selfish way. He meant that there was an obligation on the part of those who were advantaged to lead the group, and that is often lost sight of when Du Bois is reproached for a supposed elitism. It's really just a perfectly legitimate idea that with ability comes an obligation of leadership.
The most quoted line from Souls of Black Folk, even Du Bois repeats it, is the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. Was Du Bois simply saying that race was a problem in 1903 at the dawn of a new century, or was he going beyond that and making a prophecy about how slowly racial equality would come about?
Oh, I think decidedly the latter. It is prophetic in that it's not only a statement which is, in a sense, a verbal snapshot of the conditions that obtained in 1903, but it is his forecast that American society, and indeed much of the global society and community, is going to be bedeviled by the business of race. He meant that, too, I think, in a somewhat broader way than simply pigment. I think it becomes clear soon after the publication of The Souls of Black Folk that he's also speaking of the economic consequences of racism, and that the two things really do go together, that the exploitation of people based on pigment is, of course, driven by and complemented by economic disabilities, which he will give more and more emphasis to as the years go by.
Do you have a favorite passage or a favorite part of the book?
There is. It's hard to select from what is such a luminous text, but so arbitrarily, I would take the passage in The Souls that reads that it is, he says, to be a poor man in a land of dollars is hard. To be a poor race is the very bottom of hardship. And that quotation, I think, speaks to what I was just saying about the economic implications of the problem of race in the 20th century, as Du Bois conceived it.
What still is the significance of Souls of Black Folk?
Well, in every group experience, there's a moment when there is an articulation of aspirations and of conditions that is simply unique, memorable, poignant, and this is such a document. It's a photo of conditions at the moment, but it's also a crystal ball of what is to come, both a warning of how American society will find itself travailed if it is not faithful to its highest political and social ideals, and his insistence that one must fight to make sure that those ideals are always to the forefront.
Well, Professor Lewis, thank you so much for visiting with us.
My pleasure.
I've been talking with David Levering Lewis, the author of W.E.B. Du Bois' Biography of a Race, and the second volume of the biography, W.E.B. Du Bois, The Fight for Equality and the American Century.